For decades, milk has been fueling women marathon runners as the OG performance drink. And in the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers takes us on a journey of self-discovery as she meets several groups of empowered women runners to find out what drives them, what fuels them, and what pushes them to go the distance. And in the process, she learns that she, too, can be a distance runner. You can watch the series at runningsucktheseries.com and register for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
I think we can all agree the current political moment is fraught. But how does it compare to the other fraught political moments in history?
It felt for a time in part of that decade like everything was falling apart. Young people against old people, anti-war violence, peace movement.
I'm former U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara. And this week, presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin joins me on my podcast, Stay Tuned with Preet. We talk about difficult times in America's history and how its people overcame them. The episode is out now. Search and follow Stay Tuned with Preet wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to the 100th long-form podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here, as I have been 99 times before, with my co-hosts Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey, fireworks sound effect. Fireworks exploding
Insert
everywhere.
Here. 100.
It's been quite a ride.
Sure has. Sure has, buddy.
I didn't think there was the way that all three of us would still have survived 100 episodes.
And
there would have been like a major blowout.
Yeah, still talking to each other.
Yeah.
It really helps that we have to come to the same office every day.
Yes. Helps and hurts.
It's a factor.
We were figuring out what to do for this 100th, and we have decided to do a clip show in part because all of us watched lots of sitcoms as children, and I always really loved those clip shows.
Yeah, so I told someone we were doing a clip show, his reaction was like, oh, hope it doesn't suck like that Seinfeld clip show. Oh.
It's not going to.
So we're gonna play some of our favorite clips from the first 100 episodes with a little backstory chatter between them.
And, before we start, I think it's worth saying that I'll speak for myself, probably you guys too, genuinely surprised at how many people have listened to this, how many people tweet at us and send us emails and, you know, get something out of it. I would say at the beginning we kind of thought, this would be a cool thing to do, but it's amazing the people that listen to it, and we just like appreciate anyone who listens to any episode, much less there are people who listen to every episode. So before we start, we got a couple sponsors, as I understand it.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code LONGFORM when you're checking out. A better web starts with your website.
We've got one more sponsor, and they've really been with us for many of these 100 episodes. It's almost like a fourth host.
Yeah, absolutely. We keep an extra chair in the room for them.
Like Elijah.
Yes. Like Elijah. Yes. Elijah this week, as every week, is Tiny Letter. It's a simple, elegant way to send an email newsletter. It is done by the good people at MailChimp, and we thank them for all of their sponsorship of the show. It has really made the thing worthwhile and able to happen.
And thanks to all of the sponsors we've had over these 100 episodes, people who've reached out to us, who listened to the show, and they wanted to advertise their business, and this is what makes it possible. We thank you to everyone who's been a supporter.
All right, enough of this.
Let's get to it.
Academy Awards talk.
And my mom.
All right, here we go. This is the third episode of the podcast, but actually taped many months before we started the podcast. It was like a pilot episode, sort of.
It was when the podcast was still vaporware.
Except we weren't selling it to anyone but ourselves.
Yeah.
So it was like the self-deceiving.
I think you were selling it to us, which you did very effectively.
Yeah, the idea that we could get David Gran onto the podcast, a person that, you know, we all like be kind of obsessed with if you're interested in this work, that maybe gave it a little momentum in my mind that it could be a real thing.
It made you guys take it at least like somewhat seriously.
Well, to be clear, David Gran was, I think, all of our number one guests. So I feel like the experience here was like, yeah, man, I'm trying to start a little cafe. We're going to have an open mic night. I'm trying to lead off with Led Zeppelin on the first night.
Also, it should be noted there was only one microphone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it is like that, except like Led Zeppelin showed up and like you had no amps or like any PA system of any kind.
Yeah.
It's like, you guys can just do an acoustic set, right?
I don't know exactly how we were intending to even do the introductions to the show, because we had literally one microphone, which we had not even purchased for the show. It was just a USB microphone I previously owned.
Yeah. And I went to the New Yorker to interview David Grand and just plopped that thing down on like the middle of a conference room table. And it was just like, okay. Podcasting.
Still, though, I would say we got, you know, we got to hear about what how David Grand works in a real way. Yeah, and I feel like that was, I love this one.
So this the clip we're going to play now, I think all of our questions and a question many people might have when reading his stories, stories like The Chameleon, is how does he come up with these twists where there's already a mystery and then another mystery sort of pops on top of it, like these unbelievable twists in real time in the story.
Yeah, I'd been that was like the number one question I wanted to ask him, and I was really surprised by his answer.
You don't always know all the answers. I mean, I think that's what kind of makes life interesting. I mean, the thing that makes these stories real, while they are in some ways unfathomable in ways, but what also makes them real is there is a uneasiness of certitude, because there are things that are not always known, and there are elements of doubt, and that can be, I think, very haunting. You know, I read a lot of detective fiction, but I think the reality of understanding the world and living with doubts and you know is very haunting, and I think it can be, I think, in some of the stories, you know, again, you get as close as you can to all you know, and then there are parts that elude you.
The stuff that's never going to get tied up.
It's just never going to get tied up. And yeah. And I mean, I think the, you know, one of the things too is in these stories is people often ask me in how you disclose information in a story too. I mean, a lot of stories are written about our mysteries to some degree, and they have an element of mystery. And so stories unfold, right? I mean, it goes back to the whole thing you said about the newspaper, the last graph. They would take my last graph and make it the first graph, right, when I write my newspaper story. And in these stories, you don't say at the very end, at the first paragraph, oh, we didn't get the giant squid, right? You let the process unfold. Right. But I think you are actually being more true to the way the world is, and the way, because I'm not writing about myself. I'm writing about characters making discoveries in time and making realizations. And so when those initial investigators investigate Cameron Todd Willingham, they collect all this evidence and they are convinced this is the truth. And so the twist when that begins to crack is actually how it happened. When the ground shifts, the ground shifts because that's the way it happened.
So for episode 4, I talked to John Mualim, writer for the Times Magazine, a wonderful writer who happens to be a close friend of mine. And this one was, to me, interesting to go back and listen to, because I feel like we are good enough friends that we just started talking and as freelancers and as writers and sort of forgot, or maybe just assumed that no one would ever listen to the podcast. And so I feel like in a way it sort of got more real than I expected it.
Yeah, it's like it does kind of like play like you guys didn't think anyone was going to ever listen to it. And it's also, I don't know, it's like one of the more honest moments on the podcast, I think.
Yeah, so here's, this is John talking about, mostly about what it's like to be a freelancer and sort of the potential of being jealous of other freelancers who are out there in the world, and sort of like how he deals with that vis-a-vis how I do.
Freelance writer self-help group.
I mean, so much of both the lifestyle and then the ability to be the least bit successful at this, I think, is just as much emotional and constitutional, you know, about your own constitution as it is about any real skill set. Because you just have to be able to keep this whole other layer of anxiety and issues that have nothing to do with the actual work. You have to be able to keep it relatively calm enough to be able to sit down and get anything done.
And how do you look at sort of other writers or read other magazines? Because I always thought one of the hardest things was, even if you're not a sort of really competitive person or a person who gets jealous of other people, if you are writing feature stories for magazines, every week and every month, there's, you know, 50 examples of people doing what you're doing in a very public way.
Yeah, better.
That, yeah, that you can read and say, oh, shit.
I've always felt like, you know, everyone, whenever you talk to people about this, they always want to know, what, you know, is it, what's it like living on the West Coast as opposed to in New York and doing this work? And I've always clung to the idea, perhaps fraudulently, that there's a benefit to living away from the center of publishing because you're not constantly running into these people. You know, you don't have to constantly measure yourself against, you know, other people. And I think that there's some truth to that, but I also think that what you're saying is absolutely right. That it does help to meet people. And like I said, it's only been in the last few years that I really feel like I've gotten to know, especially people sort of our generation. You know, I'm just beginning to meet a lot of those people and get to know them. And then it starts to feel more collegial. I mean, it does feel like you start rooting for particular people, as opposed to, you know, having to avert your eyes, you know, after you read the first graph because you're just too scared and ashamed. There's a benefit to keeping everything as a complete abstraction and just trying to do your work as best as you can, which is for the most part what I've done. But I could imagine that being really plugged into those worlds is also has its comfort.
So next up, still in the early ones, episode 7 is Ta-Nehisi Coates, who we actually had on again recently. But this early one, you know, we went up to his house and talked to him, and it felt to me, I mean, we'd already had some great folks on in the very early ones, but it felt to me like, oh, if we contact someone, even if we think like they're probably too busy with important things to talk to us, that they were kind of open to it. And, you know, it was exciting to talk to them. And there was a million things in this one that we could have excerpted.
Yeah, they'll even let you come right to their house and sit in the living room. It was like, it was a very warm summer day. And the other thing I remember about that is that his cat climbed into my backpack.
It would be a great way to burglarize houses. You just invite someone to go on your fictional podcast and rob them.
Yeah. So here this is Ta-Nehisi talking about sort of family life and how that helped to focus him as a writer.
Sorry about how we robbed your stuff.
So I was 24 when my son was born, and people always say the kids get in the way, right? But it actually had the opposite effect on me. Like, I feel like I could have spent my 20s doing all sorts of self-destructive things. That was my natural inclination. But having a kid suddenly makes that not okay, right? It's fun to stay out late and get drunk and fall asleep on the subway. But if you don't come home, it's not just you that's in trouble. You know what I mean? Like, there are other people who are now at stake. By that point, I was a writer. That was what I, you know, had chose to do. Either I was going to do that well or other people were going to suffer. So everything, like the stakes of everything just went up. You know, I think I'm the sort of person that I for whatever reason, and I probably will dive in also because of this, I only respond to pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that just so, I mean, that kid just so raised the pressure for everything.
Here we are at episode 9, longtime friend of Long Form and the Long Form podcast, Jean Marie Laskus.
Max and I go down to Pittsburgh once a semester and talk to Jean Marie's writing students. It's a great program out there, and she's always got something crazy to talk about.
She does. She's one of these people, you know. You like you hang out with her for 10 minutes, and you're convinced you've known her for years, you know. And that's kind of what we were talking about here, was just this way she has with people, and the way that she connects with people and gets them to open up, and she spends all this time with folks. And you know, I've actually felt her doing it with me before, and so I sort of asked her about that. And she really was like, she really tried to answer, although it's kind of an impossible question.
If I'm doing my job right, I'm blank. You know, I'm a sponge. I'm just drinking up what this person's giving to me. So if I'm, you know, successful, I probably have reached that. But I just don't think it's that different from like being like a friend with someone. I don't have any awareness of what the heck you're talking about. I'm trying to figure it out.
I don't know what I'm talking about either. I mean, I guess I'm. That seems like the thing that maybe I was looking for is that your relationship with the people that you're covering
it seems to me, is quite similar to how I've seen you relate to people when you're not going to write about them.
I'm just a writer going in here, you know. I'm not really... What do you do with that kind of intensity of a relationship when you're then your job is to this evoke it on the page? It's a huge, not just privilege, it's a responsibility. Because, you know, it's just for a story. And I tell them that, you know. Like, I'm asking you to trust me, but at the same time I'm telling you don't trust me. You know, I'm kind of like a vulture in this relationship. We're not friends.
The next one is from episode 10 with Chris Jones, which was funny partly just because he and I were at a journalism writing conference in Romania, and I had said, hey, I'd never met him before, and I said, hey, maybe you could do the podcast, and then we talked to the organizer of the conference, and we're like, maybe we could do a live one, and then they just filled this room with people. I guess they were journalism students or something, but we ended up doing it before this big crowd.
Yeah, this one's super raucous.
Yeah. And we were both drinking sort of like throughout the whole thing.
It was you were drinking drinking beer.
Yeah.
Stomaching the beer.
I know. It was a mistake.
I understand that later that night someone went to the hospital.
It was the next night that someone went to the hospital after a middle of the night trampoline accident, which tells you something about how that conference ended up.
I want to go to this conference.
But Chris Jones, he both sort of talked about how he worked, but also kind of like got into some personal issues that I thought were, you know, pretty amazing to hear him talk about, because I feel like, you know, online and other places, people don't know that side of him necessarily.
I'm reading the biography of David Foster Wallace right now.
The DT Max
book. And I fear so much that young writers are going to read something like that and think, for me to be a great writer, I have to be mental. I have to be a head case. And it's not true. You can be a great writer and be totally, totally sane. I think sometimes people romance things like depression or romance things like broken hearts. And it's... Once you've been there, there's nothing romantic about it. It's awful. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. And for me, you could not rock me up or down for the first probably 30 years of my life. And then I just suddenly started swinging. And it's like how, for me, it's like how, you know, if you're looking at your soup, you're walking with your soup, and if you look at it, it starts to slosh a little. And once it starts sloshing, you can't stop. And then if you look at it, you spill more. For me, once it started, it just was really hard to crack. And I think if you have ever gone through depression, the first time you do, you don't know what it is, and you don't know that your life is ever going to feel different. You suddenly get into this spot where you're like, I can't see how my life will ever get better. And for me, there was two instances where, you know, I thought seriously about killing myself. And I think that the other thing is we put all nice words into it. You know, passing away or leaving us, or, you know, suicide is killing yourself. It's choosing death over life. And it's nothing fun or romantic or beautiful or poetic. It's shit. And it's I wrote that story because I hoped that people who were in that same spot, especially people who are in that first skid of depression, would read it and think, okay, maybe there's a when I can get out of this. Maybe there's a way I can get out. And, you know, I got out.
Hey, looks like on this clip I was talking to Charles Duhigg. We're on episode 22. Charles Duhigg, when we had him on the show, he was off of doing all those Apple stories for the New York Times. He did an 8 or 9 part series. And I wanted to talk to him about that. But I sort of ended up talking to him. Different people in the show, I don't know if you guys have this experience. A lot of people are like, if I couldn't write, I'd be in jail. It's the only damn thing I could do with my life.
Yeah, people always say, yeah, I don't have any other skills.
Yeah, I don't have any other skills.
Work out.
Right. And I don't believe that. But of all the people, I would not believe that about Charles Duhigg. you could really imagine him doing many, many different things at a very high level. And I think he's aware of that. He's written a book about productivity. I think he's a competitive guy who could excel in many fields. And he talked about that in this clip.
You should go into everything assuming that you are going to be as successful as you can conceive of. Because that ultimately ends up being true, right? If you have the ability to work hard, and I knew I could work hard at that point. I knew I could work 100 hours a week. And if you're smart, and I knew that like life had sent me signals that like I was smart enough to figure stuff out. If those two things are true, then you should assume that over time, you are going to be as successful as you hope you will be. And so then the question becomes, okay, assuming that the best case eventually becomes true.
Mm-hmm.
What is the choice that I want to make where I will be happiest once I am successful? Because once you are successful, life actually gets harder in many ways once you're successful. And number two, how am I going to be happiest on the path to success, right? Because if I'm eventually going to become a U.S. senator or become a best-selling writer, it might take 10 to 15 years. And so Which of those paths is that 10 to 15 years going to be happy? And then once I actually get that position, once I hit that point, which of them is going to be more is going to make me happier.
So for this next one, I interviewed Matt Power, who this was episode 29. And Matt, as most people will know, or a lot of listeners will know, passed away earlier this year. And, you know, there are lots of reasons that we would include this in the show, not least that he was a great friend of all of us and an amazing person.
And a great supporter of the show.
Absolutely a great supporter of the show and, you know, connecting us with writers and connecting writers with writers. You know, that was his thing.
He just loved this stuff. Yep. And it really comes through in that episode.
Yeah. And I think it's in this particular moment, you know, I think he really captures like his approach to writing and his approach to the career, which is, you know, really driven by a sense of adventure and enthusiasm for life and a curiosity about people that I think, you know, a lot of people feel but can't articulate in the way that that he did.
And after he passed, they played a few clips of this show in various memorials on NPR and stuff. And it's, I don't know, it's always cool to be able to hear someone describing what they do in their own words. I mean, lots of times when someone dies, you're hearing a sort of a omniscient narrator narrate their life. And I thought it was, I'm just really happy we have this recording of him talking about his own life.
There was some aspect of me, which I guess is that like kid's sense of adventure, which I don't think I could have resisted even if I'd thought better of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is in a lot of ways probably why I became a writer, why I got into this stuff in the first place, is because like I wanted to have the kind of life that I, you know, not to be the story exactly, but I wanted to experience the sort of limits of things, you know.
Do you talk about that actually, the opening to this story that you wrote for Harper's about taking up this like homemade raft down the Mississippi. The opening of that story, you talk about sort of like how you met this guy who was a real true kind of free spirit, and you always felt like you were drawn back to, you could do these little adventures, but then you were sort of drawn back to something more conventional.
Sure.
And then get tired of it and then go out again. Is that how you got, I mean, is that how you got into journalism in the first place?
I mean, I think it was that love of wanting to both do things and then to tell stories about them. I don't know if it was not exactly like seeking for a higher truth, but really wanting to just have the experiential aspect of it be sort of overwhelming. Because the kind of stories I've gotten to do have involved basically fulfilling all of my childhood fantasies of adventure, like having an adventurous life, I've never felt, even though you don't make a ton of money doing it, I've never felt that I was missing out on something. You know, I haven't worked in an office since a 2-week stint as a fact checker at House and Garden magazine in 2001 was the last time I worked in an office. So that's 12 years. And I haven't starved to death yet. I mean, but I've also always lived in very sort of weird or you know, flexible situations. You know, I lived for a long time in like an artist collective where I think the rent was, I lived in a windowless crawl space, and I think it was $350 a month or $375, something like that. You know, New York is a hideously expensive until you're willing to do some really weird things, and then it's not that bad.
All right, here we are at episode 37. Ann Friedman.
Ann Friedman.
Ann Friedman. Ann Friedman's a good friend of all of ours, and on one of her semi-frequent stops in New York, she came by the office, and she was the editor-in-chief of Good magazine, and we got into like the bloodletting there. It was like the only time she ever talked about it, I think. Pretty sure she regretted talking about it, which is why that's not going to be the clip we play. The clip we're going to play is she had this thing that she actually talks about a lot, but it's about how like she really believes in like not kissing up, but like kissing sideways, and she's like a big believer in like supporting people that are on the same level of as you are professionally. And this moment in the show just got a lot of feedback, seemed to really be pretty inspiring, particularly to like young women, young lady journalists.
We'll be doing a separate show, Most Regrettable Moments.
The notion of kissing up is super weird to me. It's like you should always be like kissing down and sideways. Like, you know, like the people who are going to be working sort of alongside you and who are coming up behind you. I'm really aware of my impending irrelevance, you know, or like the idea that if you make your name as someone who is excited about the future, as soon as you start getting a little bit older, it's like, you know, it seems like you need to work harder to have that brand come across.
Yeah.
So yeah.
You got to align yourself with the future prognosticators.
Absolutely. I mean, every time I get on, and I really do like answer every email like a, you know, a baby journo sends me and get on the phone with them and whatever. But I'm waiting for that day when I'm like, you know, actually in dire need of work. I'm like, you know, 65 years old because like, no one's retiring, obviously. None of us are retiring. And I'm just like, I don't understand how to write like, you know, like on Google Glass or whatever we're going to be like composing on. And I've become like one of those people. I want there to be some like journalist who is now a features editor somewhere or like whatever that title looks like, who remembers when I got on the phone with her in 2013 and helped her negotiate for her first salary and like throws me a fucking bone. Like I think about that moment a lot. And like that's how I like prepare for old age. That and I do the crossword.
This clip is from my interview with Natasha Vargas Cooper, which I think is episode 39. I taped this in Los Angeles while I was out there on vacation on my friend Jake's floor in Los Feliz. I was talking to her at the time about doing celebrity Q&As as sort of a way to support yourself while you take on longer, more challenging stories that don't pay as well. You'll never guess what happened next.
It's basically the only moment of physical comedy in the history of the podcast, yeah. I think.
I have a very clear memory of when I was listening to the draft of this episode and I was walking through Forking Park and started like wailing, laughing, like freaking people out.
Strong.
It's a great moment.
Yeah, that happened. So you do that for money.
Yes.
And is that that's your
that
paycheck?
Helps.
Yeah.
Because those are quick. Those are just quick and dirty. Those are just like, I don't know how many hand jobs a hooker gives out a night, but I assume it's the bread and butter. So it's like, these are just
hand jobs.
Yeah. I don't know. Do people, I guess, cause they're cheap and easy and fast. Hand jays.
Are a lot of men paying for hand jobs?
I hope not. I don't know what men pay for.
I feel like I'd pay not to get a hand job.
Oh my God.
Whoa. Explosion.
Yes.
Hold on. I timed that well.
Yes. Heyo.
So what happened in that one, Aaron?
I think I spilled a glass of water.
At the moment where it just happens in an incredible moment of the discussion that you're having.
There's another point in that episode where Natasha was talking about getting pulled over and getting a DUI and spending the night in jail with no underwear. And the person whose apartment we were taping in like walked in like directly during that story. So,
and then you just knocked over another glass of water.
Yeah, I actually had a whole queue of water glasses up there for as many punchlines as possible. Who's up next?
Episode 43. Marguerite Fox. She writes obituaries for the New York Times.
Great obituaries, memorable obituaries.
Yeah, yeah. Her obits are like constantly on that most emailed list.
Yeah,
kind of things that people pass around. She distinctive thing about her, I'd never met her before, and I went to the Times to interview her, I've never met anyone like her. She doesn't just speak in like complete sentences. She speaks in like complete paragraphs. She talks exactly like she writes. And it was tons of fun.
This was kind of a off the beaten track one because she is an obituary writer. I think in the next 100, we're going to try and do some more of those. So stay tuned.
You do get emotionally involved with people, even though, of course, as a journalist, you're not supposed to. But as a human being, how can you not? Particularly people who had difficult, tragic, poignant lives. But there are also people that you just wish you had known. And the kind of painful irony is you're only getting to know them by virtue of the fact that it's too late to know them.
Right.
And truly the absolute best compliment that any obit writer can get from a reader is, it takes one of two forms, and either one is great. They'll say, I read your obit and I thought, gee, I wish I'd known that person, which is exactly the effect we're trying to achieve. And better still is they say, I read your obit and I felt I did know that person. Then we know we've done our job.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to pause this 100th episode of ours for just a second and tell you a little bit more about our sponsor. It's Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. It really is super simple. If you don't know anything about building a website, Squarespace is the answer. It's simple and easy. The design is gorgeous. You just pick a template. It works out of the box. You can drag and drop things around where you want, little widgets and cash registers, whatever you need. It's all there. They've figured it all out. If you do hit a snag, you probably won't, but if you do hit a snag, they've got 24/7 support through live chat and email. They've got people in New York and Dublin and Portland. You will not go wanting for support. Plans start at just $8 a month. You get a free domain name if you sign up for a year. All the design is responsive too, right? So it'll work on your phone or your tablet or wherever. You don't have to worry about it. That's the point. Squarespace.com. If you go and use the Longform code at checkout, so when you're paying, put in the code Longform, you're going to get 10% off. But you don't even have to do that yet. You can go right now. Start a free trial. No credit card required. Start building your website today. When you do upgrade, use that code Longform. You'll get 10% off. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring the show. They've done so several times over the course of these 100, and we really appreciate it. All right, let's get back to the memories. All right, episode 57, Eli Saslow. This one was really fun one to do. I went down to Washington and I interviewed him at the Post, and it was like the week after Bezos bought the paper, and he had just had a kid. It was just kind of weird energy in the building. People were a little stressed out, a little freaked out about
it. I feel like a nice update to this one is that that change in ownership has not changed what Eli Saslow does. Like, they're letting him do what he does. It hasn't changed.
I was gonna say, like, has anything happened with, like, everyone was like, well, will the Post be like publishing only on the Kindle now? Has anything really changed?
Yeah, around the edge. They're hiring people. I think that's the main thing, is it feels like there's energy there, and they've hired like a number of really good people in the last couple months that I've seen. So
yeah, and they definitely are like continuing to support Eli in this work. Like, he's just allowed to go out and tackle these huge projects.
Yeah.
And this was a really great episode. He really got into like the sort of like dirt of his reporting. But the thing we're talking about here was a story that he wrote about a family in Newtown that had lost a child.
It's just it's a really interesting and unusual relationship to be with somebody as a reporter, whether it's with the Bardens, or whether it's you know, being on a bus all day in Tennessee with a bunch of kids who don't have enough to eat, and then, you know, at 10 o'clock when the reporting day is over, going back to the hotel and getting room service. I mean, it's just there's sort of a contrast sometimes in what we do that just feels a little bit shitty.
We were talking about your Newtown story about the family who lost their 7-year-old. And what I was saying was that over and over again in the story, there are these big moments in there, these small moments in there, these small, tiny details, you know, putting gummy vitamins in the bottom of his smoothies. It's just never okay. Like there's no break from it. There's no respite from it. There's no like chance to take a breath or chance to laugh or anything. It's like it's never okay.
Right.
What was it like to write, Eli? I mean, like how did it affect you to spend all that time with those folks?
It was, it was really hard, but I feel, guilty even saying that, or I feel like it's not really my place to complain about it being hard for me to write, because I wrote the story and then I got to leave it. And even when I was writing the story, I was only experiencing what they were experiencing in like a super fractional way. So the hard part was that it was a story where you're right. There are no breaks. There's no, it is this relentless sort of bottomless pain. There's one scene in the story in a diner where they go for breakfast, where this mother of another kid, who had been a classmate of Daniel's, the previous year and who had survived by hiding in another bathroom during the attack, they happened to come into this diner for breakfast and
for his birthday breakfast.
For his birthday breakfast, which was this totally the most crushing reporting moment. You know, it's sitting in that diner with them, while that was happening was those are the moments that you know are important and that you work for, but they're also like, you know, that was, I hope I don't have another like sort of 10 minutes of reporting that is just watching that heartbreak just brutal.
Next up, Malcolm Gladwell. This was episode 62, and he was to that time the most famous person that we'd had on the podcast. And we got him on. He had a book coming out, and I went to his house. Max came to do the sound. And I wanted to get there early. I don't remember if I told you guys this afterwards, but I wanted to get there early because, we had a short window. And I got there early and I went around the corner to a cafe and sat down with a cup of coffee and realized that Malcolm Gladwell was sitting right next to me, basically at a table right next to me. And I kind of like hung out there awkwardly until he left, and then went to his house and rang the doorbell because I didn't feel like he wanted to be bothered by, someone who was about to interview him for an hour at the coffee shop. So it was a little weird, but I don't think he knew.
You don't think he realized?
No, he didn't say anything.
I like to think that even if he did realize, he knew not to make you feel all awkward about not saying hello.
Yeah, he's like, this amateur hour podcast interviewer. I'm just going to cut him a break.
I have a question for Max on this one. Yeah. What was the best thing you stole from Malcolm Gladwell's house?
Well, so from Ta-Nehisi's house, I got a bunch of flatware.
And do you keep this stuff like in a burrow?
Well, how do you guys think we're ever cutting any checks for this show? Pawning all of Gladwell's shit.
You're cutting checks for the show?
You got that $3 check yesterday, right?
So here's Gladwell. He's talking about, in this particular clip, he's talking about a writer that he feels like he can't do what this writer does. Pretty interesting.
You know, my great hero as a writer is Michael Lewis, who I just think Michael Lewis... I think Mike Lewis is, believe it or not, the most underrated writer of my generation. I think he's the one who will be read 50 years from now. And I think what he does is so extraordinary from a kind of degree of difficulty standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
His ability to make someone who is sort of marginal and eccentric to see what's beautiful about them. He wrote a book about Maury Taylor. I don't know if you've read that one about it. It's a random guy who ran for president maybe 20 years ago. He's just a sort of a crank, but a lovable crank. And the beautiful thing about Michael Lewis, and I learned this from him, is that he takes people completely at face value. He never questions your sort of sincerity, which is this extraordinarily hard thing to do and a lovely thing as well. I don't think people realize how hard it is to do a single narrative book. That's one of the things I admire about Michael Lewis. He seems to be able to do it effortlessly. I don't think I could pull it off. Maybe it's because I've never found an individual whose story is rich enough, but maybe I'm just not as good at developing a single story. I just think that's kind of beyond me a little bit.
I'm surprised to hear you say that.
Yeah, I think it's too hard. I would lose faith in my ability to kind of keep the reader engaged. I'm much too nervous a writer. I feel like I've got to keep giving you more different stories to kind of pad it out, whereas the amount of self-confidence that you feel in Michael Lewis's work or Janet Malcolm's work, I mean, I was just rereading Psychoanalysis and Impossible Profession. That book is just like, it's, and same thing with The Journalist and the Murderer. She's so extraordinarily sure of her gift. She's not in any hurry to start, and she knows you stay with her, right? Because she knows she can deliver, right? You're not going to run out of gas halfway through. I don't have that certainty. You know, she's, to use a sports metaphor, Janet Malcolm and Michael Lewis are the people who are quite happy to take the last shot. I'm going to pass. I'm not taking the last shot.
All right, we got another big one.
Now that we're on the big names, we just can't stop.
Yeah, this was this
play
is
the
a,
hits.
This is a fun night, man. This is episode 64, Gay Talese.
It was live at NYU.
Did it live at NYU. There's a bunch of people there, standing room only. They're like turning people away at the door.
Yeah.
And man, he was just great.
They almost turned Nan Talese away at the door.
I know.
He's a one of a kind.
Yeah, he's just a magical dude. He was just like on. From the start, it took him a little while. It took me like a little while to like break him.
Yeah,
he's got like he's got his hits. He's got his shtick.
But I would say I've seen him actually twice this year, and he's got. I think he's probably got 10 hours of solid off the cuff anecdotes that he could just tell. You could put him in, and he's like, okay, we're at a bris, and he would go. He would tell a story about it.
But then we afterwards we got the chance to go to dinner with him. Which was pretty funny.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was him, his wife, and his cousin, Nick, who was just like this incredibly possibly the only person who was competing with Gay in terms of sartorial excellence.
Yeah, it was awesome. There was like, I don't know, probably like 10 of us. And yeah. We were all like crowded around this super tiny table at the Knickerbocker.
Yeah.
And like Talese was flirting with my wife the whole time. I was super into it.
But then we didn't actually realize that his cousin, his close friend and cousin,
yeah,
is there.
I kept asking him like about himself, and he was like, "Well, I used to be a writer. I used to be a crime writer," and it was
Nick Pileggi who wrote the book and screenplay that Goodfellas is based on. Yeah. He wrote the movie Casino. Also, he was married to Nora Ephron.
Yes, yeah. Extremely unassuming man. We're gonna have him on. I actually
that was amazing.
After that dinner, I went on Amazon. I was looking at his books. He wrote at one point Playboy had a book press, and he wrote the first book in it. And it's called Private Eye, and it's a book length profile of a Long Island private investigator. So I'm gonna read that. We're gonna try and get him on.
That'd be great. There's one more thing about that dinner which I feel like we should just note, which is that towards the end,
yeah,
Talese got up. No one really noticed. He went surreptitiously, paid the entire bill,
yes,
walked back with his coat on somehow, yes, and was just like, we're going.
Yeah. He basically like ran out on the check, but it was like paying the check and running out on us.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
Was amazing.
It's just like, your time with us is done.
Yeah.
I think Gay Talese is winning in the game of life, basically.
Yep. That's a pretty awesome night.
Now, a lot of people that I meet who go to journalism schools complain there are no jobs. You have to think of journalism as an art form. You have to think as a journalist that if you want to do a kind of writing that you might think is on my level, you have to think of yourself as an artist. I thought of myself as a short story writer. The short story writers that I admire were artists. They're John Cheever and they were John O'Hara. But when you get to know success stories in the world of the art of theater, of movies, of dance, all the art forms, those young people, some of them went to college, they wanted to be an actor. And what do? They audition and they work in restaurants and they drive taxi cabs. They do a lot of grubby things to pay the rent. And when they can squeeze some time into getting an audition or maybe practicing or however actors practice, they don't just go out of college, go to Yale Drama School and then find a job with a serious drama company or get a place in a play. And so the journalist has to do the same thing. The journalist wants to do that kind of writing that we will call journalism as an art form. Instead of doing crap for newspapers, it'd be better they work in a restaurant and find time when they're not working in a restaurant to do the kind of research to fulfill your ambition as a curious person because you want to write about a certain place or a certain thing or a certain subject. Maybe you have to do it on your own. If you're going to keep working on a newspaper, you're not going to do it because they're going to tell you what to do and how long you can do and how little time you have for it. So just think of yourself as an artist and think of yourself, you know, the actors now, you think that Robert De Niro was a big success and or all these big names. Some of them, when they were 24 years old, 21 years old, before they got a break and discovered and did something that made them hireable, We're doing grubby things like cleaning toilets in some restaurant. So get a job in a restaurant.
Okay, for our next clip, this is one of the more popular episodes that's aired with Elizabeth Wurtzel.
Popular for good reason.
Yeah, she is an entertaining person. I don't think anyone can say anything different than that. She does not give a fuck. She is definitely the most unfiltered guest we've had on the podcast, and I really like talking to her. In this clip, she is talking about people who feel like she's too critical or too mean.
I really recommend, if you did not listen to this one the first time around, you should go back and listen to it. I was just looking. I remember this text message I got from a different guest who I guess I probably shouldn't name in this case. But it's just all caps. You guys are doing interviews that will go down in history.
Basically,
truly something special about this, and I'm not even sure what it is.
If you, yeah, I think that it's. I think we've got a real chemistry, me and Elizabeth Wurtzel. But if you find this clip amusing, there is a full hour available. For your streaming.
I was going to say, she was great.
She's great. Yeah. She killed it.
She was.
She came on with game.
Yeah, she had less fear than anyone who's been on the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Just because you have a story to tell doesn't mean you should be telling it. It's got to be well written. It's not your gift to give the world just because, like, you have a pen or you have a computer or you have a typewriter or whatever.
Do you think you could have come out with a book like this today? Like Prozac Nation, if you were 25 now, would this book work? Would it be the same?
I would like to think I'd come out with something else shocking because I'd still be me. I mean, things that are good are still good.
And rare.
And they're still rare. You know, it's like, but I think somebody has to invent some other new thing now. I mean.
What do you mean by that?
I don't know. There's got to be some other new thing. Like, the truth is not, like, the new thing anymore. Like, it's no longer shocking. I feel like it's funny, you know. I feel like you can shock people now by saying that, like, Lena Dunham has inexcusable thighs. I mean, she does.
You just ruined my next question. No, go ahead.
I guess, like, that's what's shocking is that, like, you know, that you're critical. I mean, apparently, like, you can't be mean. I look at the comments about things I write.
Yeah.
And they're pretty fucking mean.
Yeah.
I mean, so, like, I don't know why I can't be mean in the things I say signed by me.
Thank you, Elizabeth Wurtzel. What do we have up next here? Ah, yes. Episode 67, I talked to Evan Wright, who wrote Generation Kill. This is for anyone, I really recommend this episode. He was probably my favorite guest I've had on the show. He's fantastic.
Yeah,
man's got stories.
Man has got stories. Well, to set up this clip, he has many stories because he was, for a while, the porn reviewer at Hustler.
Which is one of the great, I mean, we have a lot of people talking about what they did along the way and the like crazy fucking jobs they had to do in order to get into to writing and journalism. But this is up there.
Well, the interesting thing is he wasn't like, I want to be like a respected journalist, but I'm going to use this porn reviewing job as a stepping stone. He was just a porn reviewer at Hustler. And I think at that point he started having some literary ambitions. But in this clip, he's talking about he was going to be able to cover the AVN Awards for a mainstream magazine, but then he got someone else who the bigger name wanted to do it, so he ended up escorting that guy and being his guide, and that writer was David Foster Wallace. So this is about Evan Wright and David Foster Wallace going to the AVN Awards together.
At Hustler, I was so out of like the mainstream that when they said, David Foster Wallace is going to do this story. I was like, who the fuck is David Foster Wallace? What kind of pretentious douchebag has like three names? This is like Mr. Howell, you know? And then that night I was having coffee with a friend and he was holding a book. He's like, you got to read this book. This guy's great. And it was a David Foster Wallace book. And I was like, who is this motherfucker? I took the book and I was reading it. And I was like, wow, he's okay. And so I actually contacted Premier and I said, if he needs any help, I will give him access to my contacts. He and I became good friends very quickly. And so you'd think it was a formula to like continue hating him or to, I don't know, have a complicated relationship. But what I learned from him is that he was very generous with me, like his encouragement. Now, Daniel Max published a book about him. And we were talking, and Daniel kind of said, well, he was probably friendly to you because you weren't like a threat, because you were like such a loser. So he, you know, but to other like real writers, he would have been more competitive, but he was super nice. So
what was it like watching him report that story?
It was interesting because he actually kind of sat in a corner with his pad of paper and did a lot of writing. And he said that he, I hadn't thought of this concept. He would try to like come up with some paragraphs and sentences in the moment. And I had always done, I'd already done some of my reporting, like real reporting. I'd never thought of that. I always do like notes and just interviews. So, and we were only in Las Vegas for a few days, and I thought, oh, there's no way he's going to really capture this. But he really nailed the industry.
Yeah, that's one of the best stories that will ever be told on the podcast, I think. Episode 75, another pretty good storyteller, George Saunders. We recorded this one in the back of McNally Jackson. And
that was one of the weirder locations.
He was like about to do this thing with Ben Stiller right after, and we like walked out, and there's just like a massive crowd of people waiting there for him.
Also, as discussed in the intro to that episode, I think I was in there doing the sound in this tiny room,
you're like,
and the
crammed
phone
behind a door,
kept ringing of people calling for tickets to the event, and people from the shop kept trying to open the door. So there was just a lot of moving parts happening in this particular episode.
Yeah, he was pretty game. He was pretty game in that conversation.
He's winning the best human being award for
He's got real advice on the show for life.
Yeah. This is the least writerly advice that this clip that will play on the show, but it's pretty good life advice.
In that speech and in Buddha Boy, he's this construction that sort of forces the listener, the reader, whoever, to think about like being on their deathbed. And what are you going to really care about? And what's really important? And what are your regrets? And, oh, I want to ask you what those are for you.
Well, I don't know. That's the thing. I mean, I've had intimations of it. And part of the thing is I think you could do work in the time before your death to get ready for it. And there's no facile. And that's what spiritual life is about. And the traditions that we all know, that's what they're about, you know. You know when you're saying goodbye to somebody at the airport that you love and you get all soft, you're like, oh my God, I hardly knew you, you know, that kind of feeling. What if that's the truth, that mode is the mode, that times 10, you know, maybe is the mode that we should exist in all the time. Then another day you're just yourself, you know. There's a big gap between those two people. So my regret would be how much time did I spend in that regular old stupid habitual mindset of taking everything for granted, as opposed to this exalted state of being super tenderized to the people you care about. And I'm guessing that if there's a heaven, it's that at the airport times 10 or 20 or 1,000, you know. So I think the regret would be that you, like a lunkhead, you spent so much time in that normal state. Well, I wonder what I'm going to do today. I hope my book is selling, you know. How do I look? Oh, I'm going bald. But instead of it, that mode is habitual, but we know from the occasional foray into it that the other mode is possible. So then the speech basically says, hurry up, take my advice, hurry up, try to get into that higher state while you can. How do you do it? I don't know. I'm stupid. I'm like a latecomer, but there's these thousands of years of spiritual traditions that wouldn't be a bad place to start.
So next up is Dan P. Lee. He was a couple episodes later, number 77. And, I really loved talking to him. He was a little bit of a mysterious character. I loved his work, but he's sort of like hard to get a hold of in a way, and doesn't have like any public persona at all.
Lives in an unheated shack at an undisclosed location.
Yeah, and then when he came in, he just was fascinating to talk to, and he really got into it about his career and how he works, but also, you know, things he doesn't like about the business, which a lot of people don't like to talk about because they're sort of afraid.
Very specific things that he doesn't like about the business. And also, we should say, like, sometimes people will say things, yes, and then afterwards they'll send us an email and be like, can you take that thing out?
And we do.
When I talked about that magazine, we do, because it's, you know, yeah.
I mean, we don't want to, you know, cost someone a job here.
Yeah.
Dan P. Lee being an exception to that.
Yeah,
role.
I thought that would be one of these things. And he had said something about Esquire, and I asked him about it at the end of the interview again because I wanted to get in a little deeper. And then I emailed him later just to say, like, hey, that's cool, because we tacked it on at the end. And he actually wrote me back and said, feel free to use anything you like. Currently without heating and holed up in a casino in Atlantic City trying to finish the story I'm a month late on. Actually love living here. But yeah, totally. I don't care.
Dan P. Lee.
Here it is. I am curious what the dimensions of the like Esquire debacle were, if they were just like the story got killed, or I mean, I also don't want you to like shit on anyone for whatever,
you know, I don't know if it's useful for me to get into this, but I'll tell you and sort of trust you, which is like the last thing, you know, as a reporter you ever do. But I think
that's why I dressed up.
Yeah, exactly. You're tricking me. Yeah.
Man, you can trust your secrets.
Yeah, exactly.
Safe in this.
I mean, this microphone obviously isn't recording anything.
Don't worry about it. Yeah.
These headphones are to keep us warm. But yeah, the experience there was just that I had had an idea for, which I'm since resurrected and I'm working on now for someone else, but for a very kind of out there story. And the experience I had with the editor there was just really, really bad. And I felt, frankly, that there was a kind of dumbing down that needed to happen with the subject. And there was kind of a muscularizing up of the prose simultaneously that was going on there that just felt incredibly, incredibly unnatural to me. It was not my voice, and that was not my story. And, you know, when you're... I guess then I was probably in my mid-20s or so. And Esquire is in front of you as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is instructive to repeat this to people who, I mean, because I don't know, you know, but that's intoxicating. And the idea that that could fall apart is so devastating.
Yeah.
You know, you think.
I think I'm right on the edge of
I'm right on the edge. I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than Esquire. And I had fetishized these magazines. And then, you know, that experience ended up being great because that isn't who I am. You know, I don't write like that. There's, you know, and again, I don't want to marginalize those magazines and say that they only do one thing. But certainly as a relatively no-name writer from Philadelphia Magazine, my kind of experimental ideas were not, you know, did not go over well.
Yeah, you're going to get, I mean, there's a house voice. You're going to get pulled into the house voice. Yeah.
And some people do that incredibly well, and I envy them for that. But that's been one of the more helpful realizations that I've had, is that that is not me. I don't do that. I don't do it well. And I frankly don't really connect to it all that well either. So it's easier to just be like, there's lots of magazines out there, fewer every day, but there are magazines out there, and there's a home for everyone, I guess.
So one funny thing related to the podcast overall in an anecdote like that is I just want to go back to when we first started.
Yeah.
We originally had this idea where the first 10 minutes of the podcast was just going to be us talking about magazine stories and kind of being like,
I think at one point it was going to be good. The whole podcast was that we were going to like critique stories. We were going to be like, so what's on the newsstand this week?
Can you imagine?
Bullshit. Sucks. Sucks.
That would be, they would have, it would be 10 listeners.
Well,
we never would have put out that podcast.
Among the three of us, I can't even tell who, like, we're all cowards.
Yeah, that's why it reminded me of that. Was just this idea that we're going to go on and say, like, you know, that story in the New Yorker last week was really not up to par. Yeah. Like, what? Oh, I'm not gonna go on.
You know
tape
who is
saying,
a, you know
what a terrible
big,
lead.
You know who is a big proponent of that format was Josh Behrman.
Yeah, yeah, the missing host.
Because you know Josh Behrman is really going to be sharply critical.
So what do we got next?
Next up, we have Ariel Levy, episode 78. I read her essay, Thanksgiving in Mongolia, which went on to win a National Magazine Award.
Yeah, people had very strong reaction. That was a powerful piece of work.
I was one of the people who had a very strong reaction, and I sent her an email and asked her to come on, and then she wrote back and she said yes, and then I suddenly got very terrified because I realized I didn't really know how to talk to her about losing her child on a hotel floor in Mongolia. And I had some time between those emails and the interview, and I still didn't really figure out how to talk to her about it. I have worked up the courage, I think.
To do what?
To ask you about Thanksgiving in Mongolia, or at least try and ask you about Thanksgiving.
It's going to be easier than you think.
Okay.
Because it's, you know, it's like, it's news to you. It's not news to me. I'm me. That happened to me. You know, I know that happened.
Yeah. Maybe you should tell people about it in case they haven't
heard. So Thanksgiving in Mongolia is an essay I wrote about this sort of... biggest experience of my life, I would say, which is that when I last Thanksgiving, when I was 5 months pregnant, I went to Mongolia to report a story and I was 5 months pregnant, and I was told, and for good reason, for good medical reasons, that it was, there's nothing wrong with flying when you're pregnant. You don't want to fly in your third trimester because, oh my God, if you go into labor early, you don't have a baby on a plane. But the fact is, there's no correlation between flying and miscarriage or birth. There just isn't. However, when I got to Mongolia, I went into labor in my hotel, and I had this baby who died. And, you know, it was the most intense experience of my life, the most epic experience of my life. And it certainly dominated my thoughts. It's still a fairly, you know, large part of my thinking process. But certainly for the first year out, it was my whole head. And I wrote about it because that is what I do. And that's what I've done since I was a little kid. If something happens, I write about it. It's just what I do. Some people see a big body of water and they think, oh, I'm going to swim across it. And some people do this, some people do that. You know, that's what I do. So that's what I did. And that's it, you know. And then I published it. That's what I did.
Have other people struggled to talk to you about it? I guess, how did it change once that story was out there? I'm trying to figure out.
Do you want me to just like help you a little bit?
Yeah, just help me along.
Okay, I'll help you.
Okay.
So before we came up with that story, my editor, Nick Troutwine, said, you know, I definitely want to publish this. We got to publish this.
Did you write it for yourself?
Yes. Well, I write everything for myself. You know, like, I don't mean to sound like a jerk, but I do. I mean,
the thing I'm trying to ask you about, okay. I guess, is why put it in a magazine?
Why not?
Because maybe you don't want to talk to a lot of people about it.
I don't talk to a lot of people about it.
Did a lot of people want to talk to you about it?
People write me, you know, but mostly people write me and say, I'm so sorry for your loss. And I say, thank you. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. Or people say, I experienced this loss or that loss. And I say, I'm so sorry for your loss. But the reason they say I had this loss or that loss is they say I felt less alone when I read about your loss. Well, that's good. I don't have a problem with that. You know, that's good. And I'll tell you what else. I'm a feminist, and I think that having a baby come out of your vagina on your bathroom floor in Mongolia is real. That's real. That happened to me. I'm not making that up. That happened. And if you're not going to write about that, what the hell are you doing? What kind of, are you a writer? And I think the idea that blood and birth and tragedy of a distinctly female nature, you know, that's real. That's as real as, you know, I'm going to go hunting swordfish, whatever. Right. You know what I mean? This is real. That's what women do, is they push human beings out of themselves. That's intense shit. And it goes wrong a lot. It's gone wrong for a lot of my friends, yeah. And it's gone wrong for me. And that's part of being a woman. That's part of being, I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know. Some people have better experiences with it, and some people don't have children. And that's all real. But this is my reality. And birth is a lot of women's reality. And I don't understand why you wouldn't write about that if you were a writer and you were a feminist and that was your reality. I don't understand why you wouldn't.
Next up is Sabrina Rubin Erdley. I interviewed her for episode 84. She's a writer for Rolling Stone. I really love her work, so I've been looking forward to talking to her, trying to schedule it for a long time, and we finally sat down. I recommend the whole thing. When we were listening to it again, this clip stood out, you know, partly because it sort of references something that we face, or anyone in this, you know, particular line of work faces, in terms of byline diversity, and we think about a lot in terms of, you know, even the diversity of people that we have on the show, and trying to improve that, and taking suggestions from people who, email us about guests that we should have on, whether it's different types of jobs or, you know, gender diversity or any other type of diversity. We're kind of trying to work on that. It was interesting to hear her talk about the barriers that she faced trying to get into this business. A brilliant writer who kind of ran up against this when she was a young writer getting into big magazines. So we thought we'd, you know, play a little bit of that, of her experience.
I will say that the industry has actually changed, I mean, in the last 20 years, in the last like 10 years, in terms of its receptiveness towards women. I mean, I definitely see there being a new demand for women and for ideas, story ideas having to do with women. I mean, never before really did you see as many stories in general interest, or certainly in men's magazines, where women were the main character. You know, you're starting to see more of that, more stories that used to be categorized as women's interest simply because there was a woman's, a woman in it. So in addition to, I think, these places starting to be more welcoming and realizing that, like, diversity in your newsrooms is a good thing. You know, it leads to bigger and better ideas, a better understanding of your world. So I think everybody's benefiting from that.
Getting close to the present day here as we've zoomed through history. Next up, episode 88, I talked to Sam Biddle from Valley Wag. This one was
Why'd you even have Sam Biddle on?
This one was controversial. Well, the funny thing about Sam Biddle is there was a lot of people up in arms about him being on this show. Not a lot of people. By a lot of people, I mean like three people. But everyone I've ever talked to who, quote unquote, hates Sam Biddle is very, very familiar with his work. His critics are, he keeps them close. What he's talking about in this clip is being a tabloid journalist and what that means and why that's not a label that he shies away from. It's something he takes pride in.
ValueWag is, and just like Gawker.com, they are both tabloids.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what it is. People often say, oh, you know, yeah, right, you guys write for a tabloid. I'm like, yeah, we'll be the first ones to admit it. The best story that I think we've covered so far, it'll be almost a year since ValueWag has restarted last spring, was the Sean Parker wedding, the Facebook billionaire who had his nuptials in a redwood, an endangered redwood habitat. Whenever someone is completely removed from the standards of behavior that everyone else is held to, that's a great ValueWag story. You're dealing with people who live in a fantasy world, both of in terms of what makes sense as a business and what is okay behavior for a human. I mean, you have people who will. There was one yesterday that will help people find get paired up with private jet pilots, and this is that this could be a viable business on its own is nutty. But then you have them applying the same sort of wacky senses of judgment to their private lives. So it usually goes both ways.
Oh, looks like me again. Episode 91.
Didn't see you there.
Hello, Aaron. Michael Lewis. This was our dream, was to get him on the show.
Say a little bit about who Michael Lewis is, maybe for the.
I think it's actually Michelle Lewis. We tried very hard to get him on the show, and at one point we said, I think we'll show up anywhere you are in the world at any time with microphones. We'll come to your house. And the response we got was, please don't come to my house. So his publicist, who was, this should be in no way looked at as a knock on his publicist, who was amazing, was like, I'm going to get you 1.5 hour. It's going to be a phone interview. It'll be 30 minutes. And then he will go. And I thought, okay, if I really entertain him and I've really got him going, he'll be having a great time. He won't even notice.
Lose track of time.
And that was exactly how I felt like it was going. And then right on a dot, the phone rang at the end, and it was a radio interview for some call-in show, and he was just gone. So, Michael Lewis,
you concentrated on some great
stuff. I thought we had chemistry, but in this clip, I asked him what. If he had it over again when he made the switch from working on Wall Street to becoming a journalist, would he do it again in the present day? And his response is quite interesting. If you had it over again and were young now, do you think you would have made the same move to journalism?
Probably not. And the reason I say that
I mean, if you're taking some version of me that is now 23 years old.
We'll put like tinkly music over this so it'll signal a flashback.
but I would have grown up in the world that a 23-year-old now has grown up in. And for the first place, I would not have probably have serendipitously ended up on Wall Street in the first place. I would never have gotten a job, and I would not have probably not gotten into Princeton. So I would have had a different trajectory in life probably right from the start.
You had a very negative view of future time-traveling Michael Lewis.
Yeah, no, going backwards. If you took me the other direction, I might even be more of a success. But the competition has gotten steeper, gotten stiffer, and so I assume I would do less well. I would be less well positioned for like Wall Street success at 23 now than I was when I was 23. But let's say I was, you adjust me slightly and my character slightly, so that I got A's in school all the time and my board scores were perfect and I was student body president and captain of the football team, and so I got to go to Princeton and I worked my way into the position to get a job at Goldman Sachs. The amount of investment I would have put into getting that success would have made it virtually impossible that I would have turned my back on it. The key to me, my decision to like chuck a Wall Street career and go be a writer, is that I'd put almost no effort into getting a Wall Street career. It had really landed in my lap, and I had this other thing that I had put a lot of effort into and really loved doing, which was writing, and I'd done it all on my own without any, you know, like help from teachers or anything. I was just, you know, trying to freelance and having some success at it. It made it very easy for me to just walk away from it because I hadn't invested anything to get it. You wouldn't be able to do that now. You'd have to have invested so much to have success on Wall Street. You couldn't imagine walking away from it.
For the record, I do not believe Michael Lewis's assertion that he would not be successful at these various things. I don't believe he believes that either.
You should talk to Charles Duhigg.
Yeah, that's Charles Duhigg, and that would be like a great debate off. For episode 95, which I feel like was like last week, but apparently it was actually 5 or 6 weeks ago, I talked to Wesley Morris, the film critic of Grantland, a charming gentleman who actually came by the office and watched a little World Cup with us. In this clip, I was asking him, you know, as a writer who writes movie reviews ostensibly, but often talks about race and gender and how our society operates, why he did so, and I thought his response was quite interesting. So I very much remember the era of, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down, kind of like, I give it a 8.6, like, and that kind of stuff. But when I go on the internet today, and I think this is the most true of serial TV, but that probably means it's coming from movies too, mm-hmm. You know, there are 45 think pieces about rape in Game of Thrones. Mm. It's almost like we want to talk about rape. Like, let's hope it's like coming up in a TV show, you know, or misogyny in True Detective.
Mm-hmm.
There's a level to which, past just giving a rating, now I think a lot of the ways that people want to talk about these larger political issues or whatever we want to call them is through the lens of pop culture and entertainment. Does that worry you going the other direction too, that we're sort of getting away from the material and just talking about the things we want to talk about?
That's a really good question.
Or are afraid to talk about, no, potentially?
That's a great question. Here's what I think. I think that this is exactly what we wanted to happen. We wanted to sort of think about what our TV and our movies and our music and our books are doing. I think that the proliferation of those sorts of pieces and that kind of thinking and that sort of engagement is a good thing. I don't think it's bad. I do think in some ways that a lot of people aren't really equipped to do it. Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
I think that there are people who feel like it's the moral thing to do to point out the fact that, you know, Mad Men introduces this Dawn character, played by Tiana Paris, and she's Don's secretary, and it seems like the show is going to devote a chunk of itself to her and yep. her life. And then she doesn't, nothing comes of it. She's just some secretary. But the show, at least for three episodes, makes you think that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I would love to read a bunch of pieces about what a problem that is or what a problem it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
The problem for me at some point is that a lot of those pieces are about other people's pieces.
Yes.
It's like, it's a lot of like breaking news. Like somebody was there, had a thought, published a thought, and then the deluge of other thinking is based from that original thought, but only a kernel of what was interesting about that thought remains in the other thinking.
Yeah.
And the thing that I love reading when that people do in these sort of in these think pieces, you know, I don't like that term.
No, neither do I.
But I mean, whatever. It's the term we have. We have no choice. And a lot of it has to do also with having something to say that is either personal or using your authority, your position of authority. Like if you're an Emily Nussbaum or an Andy mm-hmm. Greenwald or, you know, Alessandra Stanley. Like if you're one of those people and you have a position from which to say these interesting things, these smart things, you should use it to say them. And if you are a person who, for instance, is a Game of Thrones fan who is tired of the sexual assault on women,
yeah,
I would love to read the sort of somewhat personal piece that like lays a case for why that's a problem.
Funny thing about that clip is it's one of the few remaining moments out of the massive amount of editing that Jenna Weiss-Berman had to do. I could not stop talking to Wesley Morris. He is truly a master conversationalist. And
at least that one was not one like where it was there was any reason for you to keep it short.
So Max told me very, very specifically that Jenna only had one day to edit it and that it would be best if I could make it about the length of an episode. I went ahead and made that well more than twice the length of an episode, and Jenna heroically edited it down to size on a very tight schedule, which brings me to now that we're that's the last clip. Thank you.
Present
all.
Day.
Thanks for listening. We've reached the present day. The people who really deserve a thank you here and who are the fourth hosts and a major creative role behind the show are our editors. Our original editor was Lauren Kirchner. She edited the bulk of the episodes you've been listening to. The show would have been totally impossible without her. We thank her very sincerely for all the hard work she put in and for believing in us when we were just talking about having a podcast and didn't really seem like we were actually going to do it. And also thank you hugely to Jenna Weiss-Berman, who stepped in on short notice when Lauren departed for greener pastures and has been editing the show since and doing an incredible job. Thanks to both Lauren Kirchner and Jenna Weiss-Berman.
Yeah, just to be 100% clear, the show would not have happened without the two of them.
Definitely not.
Definitely not. Would not happen even now.
Yeah, it would not happen this week without
them. So while we're at it, thanking people, because some of them listen to the show as well, we want to thank the guests who have appeared on the show. What is that, 99 guests. Extremely busy people who are trying to make a living writing, which is not an easy thing to do, and taking out the time to come over here and talk to us or meet us in strange places with microphones on ironing boards and all the strange interviews that we've done on site.
All those nude episodes. tape.
Yeah, those are coming in the 200th episode clip show. So we just really appreciate everyone taking the time to come talk to us.
Yeah, and we also appreciate everyone listening. I think we can all agree that way more people are listening to the show than we ever expected.
Fact.
Yeah, it has been, it's just been really fun. It's just been really fun to do. It's been fun to know that people are listening. It's been particularly sort of gratifying to get a lot of emails, particularly from like young writers who seem to really get some value out of hearing these people talk and sort of share their wisdom. So thanks. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to all the sponsors. Thanks to everyone who believed that an all-nude show could take off. We'll be back here for at least 100 more. Thanks. Leave us a review. Send us an email at editors@longform.org. We appreciate it. We'll be back next week. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah. I don't want to do your dirty work no more. I'm a fool to do your dirty work. Oh, yeah.
Why do you run? Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.